owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. 78 years ago, the forces of the Imperial Japanese Navy launched a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. The attack ushered the United States' entry into World War II. On December 11th, 4 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Nazi Germany also declared war on the United States. The declaration was made by Adolf Hitler, apparently without much consultation with his military leadership. Up to that point, the U.S. was officially, I use the quotation fingers, neutral in the war in Europe, but the Nazi declaration was to bring the full might of America to bear down against Germany. Hitler's declaration is only one of several curious decisions, which when examined through the reverse lens of history makes one scratch their head. Joining us today on American Warrior Radio to talk about some of those decisions and what might have been had different decisions been made is David Pine. David is a well-respected public policy expert and national security commentator who's written a very interesting series of articles on how the outcome of the Second World War could have been much different. You can find those at realclearhistory.com. David, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate you inviting me on the show on this Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, in which we honor the 2,300 sailors and airmen who lost their lives when the Japanese attacked.
Well, David, it's a real pleasure, and I'll tell you, let me just ask you a favor. All your series of articles, very well-researched, very extremely well-written, but also very much in-depth. So I'm going to have to ask you to dumb it down a little bit for me because there's a lot of stuff.
Okay.
A lot of stuff in there we want to cover. First, let's establish your bona fides, David. You, you're a former Army officer. You, among other things, ran the International Programs Manager for Army Headquarters Staff responsible for the countries of the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, Middle East, the Americas, and Africa, which probably has something to do with what the articles you wrote. You were the International Analyst for the Office of the Secretary of Defense and former National Security Policy Director for Senator Mike Lee. Senator from Utah, former senator from Utah.
So it was during his campaign. I was his national security policy director.
Okay. And something that we probably won't get into, we might talk a little bit about today because it scares the heck out of me, but we'll see how it goes. You're also the director of the Utah EMP Task Force. Tell us real quickly, David, we've done shows on EMPs before, but what does the Utah director of the EMP Task Force do on a daily basis?
I am part of a national team. So our executive director is Peter Pry, Dr. Peter Pry, who is the foremost expert on EMP in this country. And we have we coordinate with him at the state level, and we've met with every member of the congressional delegation or their office to try to get them to support hardening the grid. So there's we've had the Grid Act, the Shield Act, we have the SEEP Act. Only the SEEP Act passed. We also had President Trump passed or signed an excellent executive order on EMP defense. But we're just trying to get Congress to fund the EMP hardening of the nation's electrical grid, power grid, and we estimate that would cost about $2 billion. So drop in the bucket, that's 0.25% of the president's defense appropriations request.
Well, I tell you what, we might do another show with you later on about that. As I mentioned, we've talked about it a couple months ago, and that just scares the heck out of me. But let's go back in the Wayback Machine and talk about your articles that can be found at realclearhistory.com. David, when I was growing up, I was a big comic book collector. And some of my favorite comics were when they took the established characters and storylines and put them in an alternate universe. I think they were actually called What If, those series of comic books. And so that's what first attracted me to the series that you wrote. So let's kind of jump back in the alternate Wayback Machine. And let's begin with where you really began your articles, David, about how the Allies could have actually prevented the war with Germany altogether. And this takes us really all the way back to the treaties that ended World War I, doesn't it?
Yes. So I did a series, I think it was back in January, it was a four-part series on intellectualconservative.com, and it hypothesized what if the Allies had actually had a just treaty or a negotiated peace with Germany after World War One, how history would have developed. And essentially what I discovered in further research for that article series was that if the Allies had ended reparations to Germany by 1929, Hitler would never have been able to ride the anti-reparations wave to power. And so the reparations was kind of the reason that Hitler was able to come to Hitler and the Nazis was able to come to power. And then in terms of why World War II started, the Polish corridor was kind of the reason for that. If there hadn't been a Polish corridor at the end of World War One under the Treaty of Versailles, I believe that Britain, France, and the United States would never have participated in what would have been a exclusively German-Russian regional war, rather than the expansive global war that we had in World War II.
David, not to take the wrong side in this whole discussion, but in your research, have you found any treaty like that, the first Treaty of Versailles that ended World War One, that was so lopsided? I mean, it really, really was punitive. Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, so the Treaty of Versailles is actually, it is one of the most severe peace treaties. This is probably for another program, but we actually did not have a peace treaty with Germany ending World War II, and the peace we imposed upon them after World War II was far more severe and murderous and destructive than the Treaty of Versailles, the Treaty of Versailles has been criticized because it was not so harsh as to make it a Carthaginian peace like we imposed upon Germany after World War II, but it was not, it was not sufficiently, just or generous to ensure that they wouldn't have a rationale to fight us again in World War II.
David, explain. I'd never heard that phrase Carthaginian peace before. Explain to us what that means.
Well, I guess a Carthaginian peace refers to ancient Rome. Early Roman Empire had a rivalry with Carthage for control of the Mediterranean Sea and the Mediterranean region. And the Second Punic War, but their final war with Carthage, they decided to essentially destroy Carthage and salt the earth. So Carthaginian peace is essentially one of the most brutal pieces you can imagine. Now, obviously, we didn't do that with Germany. I mean, we certainly starved millions of Germans to death. That was very lamentable, as well as their POWs. So it's essentially it's a very harsh peace, which ensures that they are so crushed that they know there's no way they can possibly come back and fight a war to retake what they lost.
I found it very interesting, and you really, in your article, you've got some very precise details where you even pulled parts of that treaty out and examined them. There's a reference to war guilt, and I found that very interesting. And you propose, David, that really if the Kaiser had been allowed to continue, if the German monarchy had been allowed to be preserved and continue, that also probably would have prevented the rise of Hitler, correct?
Yes, because the reason for that is the Kaiser, most of the conservative German parties of that time period were monarchist, and they ultimately wanted to restore the monarchy. Of course, it would be a constitutional monarchy similar to Britain's. A lot of people don't realize that before the end of World War One, in October 1918, the German Reichstag passed essentially a new constitution, which took away the Kaiser's power and transformed Germany into a constitutional monarchy. Unfortunately, that wasn't enough for the Allies. The Allies insisted on his abdication. But the reason that I wrote that is because Hitler could never become Führer Fuhrer was a position that never existed in Germany before. It was essentially a fusion between the offices of president or head of state in Germany and chancellor or head of government. And he might, I mean, all things being equal, he might have rose to the position of chancellor, but he couldn't have been the true all-powerful dictator of Germany because the German army would still have an oath of allegiance to the Kaiser, not to Hitler as Fuhrer.
Well, I tell you, that's just some of the fascinating stuff that I've enjoyed about these articles, David. And again, people can find them, the whole series, at realclearhistory.com. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined with David Pine. We're going back into the Wayback Machine a little bit to talk about history, particular history of Germany in World War II here on this anniversary of the December 7th attack. When we come back, you know, we hear a lot about the power of the sword and not enough about the potential power of the pen. We're going to talk more about how war could have been avoided or at least contained. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking some history with David Pine. He has got just an amazing series of articles you can find on realclearhistory.com. I don't know why I have such trouble saying that, David. But really, this is the end. I talk for a living. You'd think I could do better. It is the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, but the reason I thought it was appropriate today to have you on and talk about the war in Europe is because really when one reads through your series of articles, if some of these things had happened in Europe and with Nazi Germany, I mean, it changes the entire crux of that historical perspective up to and maybe including, you know, no war with Japan and some very unlikely allies. But let's
exactly.
We'll get to that. Stick around, folks. Follow our logic here. You talk about there was not an allegation, but when Hitler was informed after they invaded, after his first invasion, when he was informed that Britain, when it had just declared war, he apparently turned as white as a sheet. He really didn't want to fight Britain and France and to some extent even Poland. His plans were to make them allies in the war against the Soviet Union. I'd never heard that before. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So, you know, Hitler, unfortunately, over time, after the Jewish communist-led revolutions in Germany that brought Germany to its knees and forced it to surrender in 1918, the end of World War One, he became increasingly a real racist, you know, a real kind of, he believed in the superiority of the Aryan race, which of course included Anglo-Saxons, British and the Germans and the Scandinavians and whatnot. And as a result, he was also very, very anti-communist. So the reason for his anti-communism, or rather the reason for his anti-Semitism, was due to the Jewish-led communist revolutions in Germany, before which I don't think he was anti-Semitic, but of course he became very murderous. We all know the at least 5 million Jews perished in the Holocaust. He wanted Britain as an ally and as much of Europe as he possibly could in what he referred to as an international crusade against Bolshevikism. And he also really respected Poland, which had managed to, at the Battle of Warsaw, defeat the Soviet army. The Soviet army was invading Poland with the ultimate objective was to conquer Germany in 1920 and communize it. They believed that Germany, if Germany were to fall, then much of the rest of Europe would follow, and then basically all of Europe could have been, continental Europe would be Sovietized. And that remained Stalin's goal to the very end, to the point where after, in 1945, he briefly entertained the idea of wanting to advance all the way to the English Channel and communize France as well, not just Germany.
Fascinating. And, you know, when one thinks about that, David, frankly, maybe not all that unsound of a strategy. There in your articles, I found it, and I consider myself pretty well versed on military history, particularly World War II, but there's a lot of gems in your articles, David. One was that immediately, the day after invading Poland, Hitler offered to withdraw and end the war if he could just keep Danzig in the Polish quarter. Explain to our listeners why Danzig was so important.
So Danzig, before the war, see, this is the interesting thing. This is why you know Hitler was actually trying to preserve the peace with Poland, Britain, and France. In every other instance, Hitler demanded a wide swath of territory. In Austria, he demanded the entire country, of course, which was German, German Austria. And then the Sudetenland, he wanted Sudetenland, which was, you know, kind of a just claim. But then he really wanted to take over minimally the Czech, what's today the Czech Republic, and possibly Slovakia as well. But when it came to Poland, the city of Danzig was not part of Poland. It was administered by Poland under the League of Nations, but it was actually an independent, it was called the Free State of Danzig. And as such, he was not demanding any Polish territory other than a one, I believe it was a 1 kilometer wide corridor, which was to be a road or road and rail corridor through Poland, connecting Danzig with the, and East Prussia with the rest of Germany, because the Polish corridor cut Germany in half. And that's what people need to realize is, as you know, as evil as Hitler was, his the German claim to the Polish corridor was a just, it was a just claim. You know, I don't think anyone in America can imagine what we would feel like if our country was divided and there was Mexico, you know, annexed a swath of territory along the Mississippi River, mm-hmm. all the way to Canada. But that's kind of the same. It was the same idea. And so that was the situation. But so it wasn't until the week before the war started that he added the Polish corridor, which in truth he always wanted. He always wanted the return of the Polish quarter, but he wanted maybe a, he wanted it to be gradual in order to make Poland an ally. And the idea was that he would annex the Pol- in fact, this is another thing I don't even think I, was in the article that I, article series that I wrote, is that Hitler summoned the Polish foreign minister in January 1939 to Berlin, and he laid down a map and he said, look, I will give you all of Lithuania. You can annex Lithuania if you give us Danzig and the Polish corridor. So he was very much into territorial exchanges in order to achieve his objectives of reuniting Germany.
Yeah, and nice. Of course, he had, easy to give away other people's land, I guess, huh?
Yeah. Well, Lithuania wasn't very powerful, unfortunately, for them.
David, and you're right, it just struck me as you're talking, you don't very often hear the name Hitler next to the word peacemaker. And that's why I found this so so fascinating. Do you have a sense what was motivating him? Was it just ruthless power? Was it the economic disadvantages that had been placed upon Germany after the Treaty of Versailles and the First World War? Was it national pride? All the above?
It was all the above, yeah. So Hitler had two chief goals. The first goal was to reunite Germany and to create a German empire at the, you know, he had given up essentially any attempt to achieve have the overseas empire similar to the British and the French. He did want the return of most of the colonies that Germany had lost, but that was an ancillary objective. What he truly wanted was for Germany to be a continental power and perhaps the continental hegemon or regional hegemon, which would control Ukraine and Western Russia. And that was it completely in line with his goal, which was equally as important to him, which was to push back Soviet communism, ideally to have to overthrow Soviet communism entirely, but to minimally push it back to what he referred to as the Archangel Astrakhan line, which went along the Volga River. And so that was the final objective of Operation Barbarossa, which was only achieved briefly in the case of Stalingrad.
David, we've got just a couple of minutes for the next break, so I don't know if we can complete all of this, but I also want to talk a little bit about another mission. He sent Rudolf Hess on a secret mission on May 10th of 1941 to try and, again, cut a deal, negotiate peace with the British, but the British weren't having any of that. And, in fact, that whole case, I think in the articles you talked about how some of the documentation on those were classified for 80 years. There was some odd stuff going on. Okay.
Yeah, the British have actually still, they've recently extended, British intelligence has extended the top secret classification for all the information relating to Hess's peace mission for another few decades. So it's very strange because they're trying to keep this all secret. I mean, what do they have to lose? I mean, it hurts Churchill's reputation, I guess, because it would have shown that Hitler was not seeking to be, you know, the dictator of the world. He wasn't trying to conquer the world. He had limited objectives. He wanted to control essentially all of Eastern Europe. Right. And that was his chief focus. But he wanted peace with Britain. He wanted peace with France. And he was willing to, this is the amazing thing, is he was, as part of the terms of his peace offer, he was willing to withdraw all German forces from Western Europe, Northern Europe, and Southern Europe, and mediate an end of the conflict between Britain and Italy. So he only wanted to keep Alsace-Lorraine, which had been German prior to World War One, and Luxembourg, which was a predominantly German city-state.
And I tell you what, David, I feel compelled at this point in time, because one of my last names is Bueller, just to say, look, we're not endorsing Nazism or Hitler or anything like that. We're just, we're
evil.
Historians.
Evil.
Yeah, we're historians looking back
right
through the lens here. David, when we come back, I'd like to talk about how if Churchill had accepted that offer and that peace treaty, how those other dominoes would have fallen all around the world, including potentially no war with Japan. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. We're talking alternative World War II scenarios with David Pine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. We're talking with David Pine, who is a former Army officer. He's done just a bajillion things. Trust me, he is well-versed in our subject matter today. You can find his series of articles about what could have happened in World War II at realclearhistory.com. David, it's interesting, even on the commercial break, I'm in talking to my producer about what could have happened and why maybe it didn't work or why it didn't work. And the focus was on the fictional series, The Man in the High Castle, I think it's called. Is that correct, John? About, you know, we're basically German. They won, and the nation was divided up between Germany and Japan. We're still talking, though, or we had up to this point, David, been talking in terms of when Hitler still had his senses about him. And later on in the war, you know, that became pretty debatable. But
it went out the window in 41. Yeah, when he declared war on the U.S., he completely had lost it by that point.
Have you been able to find, did he ask anyone, or was he just had a fit one morning and decided to send a telegram? Or, I mean, because again, it's the, you know, even the Japanese had the sense to say we've awakened the, you know, the sleeping giant or whatever it was. But did you, in your research, did you find anything about Hitler?
So it must have just been like that, because, you know, Hitler FDR had a plan, and his plan was to get do an end run around the American public and Congress, which was 80% against U.S. Involvement in the war. And it was to, you know, to sink German submarines and provoke Hitler to declare war. And then he conspired to get the Japanese to attack us at Pearl Harbor, according to a lot of books. But the best one is Robert Stinnett's Day of Deceit, published a couple decades ago. And but Hitler, he was adamant about staying, preventing a war with the United States. And so he didn't take any of the bait. But FDR, you know, he was trying to engineer a Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor as a quote-unquote backdoor to war with Germany, because he really didn't care all that much about the Pacific or Japan, Japanese aggressions. He really wanted to side, you know, to bring the full military industrial might behind his ally Britain, and he was working closely with Churchill to accomplish that objective, even while he was running for re-election in 1940, saying he was going to keep our boy, American boys out of the war. And he was all too happy to help Joseph Stalin, of course, as well, in order to achieve the goal of destroying Nazi Germany.
David, let's talk a little bit about that. If Britain had accepted his peace offer in 1941, and let's talk a little bit about those dominoes, because I find it, and again, this is very in-depth, and we don't have time to really get into the pithy details on the show today, but in the Reader's Digest version, walk us through the steps then of how that could have ended up with Japan not entering into war with us. And I love the very unlikely, or I should say more, an interesting scenario of an allied Japan and Mao Tse and the Chinese allied against Russia with us, and
sure.
Fascinating stuff. How would that have played out?
Well, the way I think it would have played out is Hitler would have had his one-on-one war between Germany and its minor allies in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Initially, I thought that the Soviets would be able to win that war outright. And the more research I did based on destruction ratios between, you know, in terms of Germany being able to destroy four tanks to one Soviet, I think that Germany would have had a stalemate that would have kind of ran along the Soviet Union's 1938 borders. That, of course, would have led to, you know, FDR kind of abandoning his quest for war with Japan in the Pacific. And he might have, you know, rather than have the U.S., U.K., Dutch oil embargo, which was a complete cutoff of any oil against Japan versus the other one that had been more mild, that would have prevented Japan from attacking us at Pearl Harbor. But even if he had done that, which he very well could have, a lot of people don't realize that Japan actually did offer, prior to Pearl Harbor, as a last-ditch effort to avoid war, they offered to withdraw from mainland China, which they had invaded in 1937, and invested a lot of manpower and, you know, had a lot of losses, as well as French Indochina, which was it was their invasion of French Indochina, which was the direct reason for FDR's crushing August 1941 oil embargo. And so if that were to have occurred, then they could have made peace with the nationalist China. And, you know, both nationalist China and Japan were staunchly anti-communist. Mm-hmm. There were checks against the spread of communism in East Asia.
And that was Chiang Kai-shek?
Yeah, Chiang Kai-shek was... Right. He was one of the best allies. He was a Christian, and he was one of the best allies the U.S. has ever had. Another interesting alternative history scenario I've been exploring is I found out that Governor Dewey, when he ran against Franklin Roosevelt in 1944, he was going to expose FDR's duplicity in terms of his foreknowledge about the Pearl Harbor attack. And had he done that, I think he likely would have won the election, which would have set off a whole new scenario where U.S. force, you know, the U.S. would have accepted the Japanese surrender offers of January 1945, summarized in the MacArthur Memorandum to FDR, and at that point would have occupied northern China and all of Korea, and communist China and Korea would not exist under either one of those alternate history scenarios.
And all those,
no North Korea and no communist China.
And all those newspapers wouldn't be collector's editions anymore. Dewey defeats
That's
Truman.
Right.
Now, okay, kind of obscure reference. Let's go ahead.
That was the election of 48.
Okay.
Those are two separate elections. Dewey was a two-time Republican presidential nominee.
That's why you are a smarter guy than I am. Let's talk a little bit of, while we can. There's really, coming back to how Germany could have won without fighting the Western Allies, you propose three basic points. And again, this is comes back to really where the pen would have been mightier than the sword. And you talk about it initially, and I'd never heard of this, David, that British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain had offered a second conference and Hitler
yes.
declined to attend. Tell us a little bit more about what that was and what could have happened.
So, you know, public sentiment was very strongly, both in Britain and France, I think more so Britain, that the Treaty of Versailles was very unduly harsh towards Germany, that Germany really wasn't guilty of the war. It was really Austria-Hungary that was predominantly guilty of starting the war, World War One. And so they wanted to kind of redress Germany's concerns, and of course doing that, you know, that was a policy of accommodation later denounced by Churchill as a policy of appeasement, really could have avoided the war between Britain, France, and Germany. In fact, it would have been assured to avoid war, and, of course, the U.S. and Germany as well. But it was abandoned. It was there are a lot of different things to talk about that we don't have time to talk about. But, yeah, the bottom line is Chamberlain, when he gave his speech, he arrived in Britain to a hero's welcome, having signed the Munich Agreement, which was viewed at the time as kind of a compromise. It didn't give Hitler everything he wanted. Hitler was actually angry that he wasn't given everything he wanted in the Munich Pact. And so Chamberlain, you know, talked about, you know, this is just the beginning of the peace agreements we want with Germany. We want to have a second peace conference, which would redress essentially all their remaining concerns. And essentially, that was the Polish corridor. The Polish corridor was the only territorial concern that Hitler really cared about that could have been resolved. And had Hitler had he been assassinated, any German leader really, mm-hmm. Been willing to accept that offer, and most then very likely Britain and France could have pressured Poland to give up 4.2% of its territory, which was the Polish corridor, and avert the war between the Western powers entirely.
You know, it just makes me shake my head, David, when you think about the millions of lives lost in that war, that it may have come down to something. Is, you know, you and I both also spend some time in the political arena, in effect, a large gerrymander. I mean, I've seen city limits boundaries extended in a more weird and strange fashion than that, much less,
yeah.
you know, a one-mile-wide corridor out to the city of Danzig. So let's talk a little bit about, because I want to get to the point where Hitler really the wheels started to come off the wagon with Hitler, and I've seen a lot
Absolutely.
Of articles, and I tell you, there's one, if you're familiar with the scene Band of Brothers, which, gosh, I've probably got the thing memorized. There's one scene towards the end of the series where the U.S. soldiers are going one way, the defeated Germans are going the other way, and one of the U.S. soldiers, you know, our guys are all in these big trucks and tanks and everything, and here's the Germans walking or you know, in horse carts, and the U.S. soldier yells at them. He's like, look at you. We're in trucks. You're using horses. You idiots, what were you thinking? And really, in your articles, you talk about for the country that really sort of perfected the concept of blitzkrieg, of lightning war,
yeah.
they really were not very mobile at the end of the day, were they? Or mobilized,
they
I
were
should say.
They were very immobile, absolutely. And that's, you know, we have kind of what has been referred to by authors far better than myself as a cartoon history of World War II. And it's, you know, it's good versus evil. It's the technological amazing prowess of the Nazi Germans against the less technologically advanced allies, and a lot of these things are just untrue. I mean, the Allies actually started the war with better tanks, better equipment than Germany. Germany had, you know, they were more proficient at mobile warfare for sure. They had better generals, but their tanks were largely inferior. And they had a lot less of them, especially when America, you know, the war was expanded in 1941 to the Soviet Union and the United States. And that completely destroyed any hope of for a German victory or even a stalemate in the war. But, yeah, absolutely. So I did the research. I can't remember, but it was something really astounding. Like, the Allies had 25 to 50 times more trucks, essentially, than the Germans did. I mean, it was just crazy. I mean, the U.S. forces in Europe were 100% motorized. The British Army started the war 100% motorized, and I believe they were entirely motorized during the entire continuation of the war. But the Germans were predominantly a horse-drawn and moved by foot. So it made their military accomplishments and victories early in the war that much more amazing.
Wait, David, hold that thought. When we come back, I want to highlight another example of that and just the disparity there between horse-drawn carts with one of my favorite aircraft of all time, the ME-262. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We'll be back with more from David Pine. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're doing some alternative potential history with David Pine. David is got a great series. And really, if you're enjoying what we're talking about here, I encourage you to go to realclearhistory.com. Enter David's name in the search bar. It's P-Y-N-E. And these articles come up. You really need to there's so much the details we don't have time to get into here today, but it's just fascinating. Fascinating reading. David, the ME-262, the Messerschmitt 262, a dual-engine jet fighter, probably 100 miles an hour faster than anything else anybody else was fielding. This thing could just tear through bomber formations, you know, stop for lunch and come back. But really, that to me is one of the greatest examples of how Hitler was no longer, if he ever was, talking to his military leadership. And probably at that point in the war, it also came down to a resource issue. But when you think about, man, if more of those things had been up in the air, or another example you cite in your articles, the V-1 and the V-2 rockets, not only a huge waste of resources based on its tactical results.
Military utility, right.
Yeah, but also just a classic case of underestimating or misinterpreting your enemy. That did not sow terror in Britain. It just strengthened their resolve.
Go ahead.
Well, how many other examples like that did you discover in your research where at some point he just, and again, the classic of, you know, Rommel sitting on his panzers while we're invading the beaches of Normandy because Hitler, nobody wanted to wake Hitler up.
You know, there are so many. Hitler was, he lost the war for Germany. He led the Germany, you know, he loved Germany. He was a nationalist, even though he was born in Austria, was an Austrian by birth. He was, he got German citizenship actually just shortly before he became chancellor. A lot of people don't realize that, of Germany in 1933. But he was really responsible for its destruction. He made so many horrible grand strategic mistakes, from, you know, failing to either invade Britain or pursue the Mediterranean option and knock Britain out of the war by occupying Egypt and Palestine and getting Turkey on the Axis side and also oil-rich Iraq. You know, he could have solved Germany's oil problem by occupying Iraq, and a lot of other options. But he just made mistake after mistake. So that was his first huge mistake. His second was not taking Moscow in August of 1941. So the German generals were united in saying, we need to pursue the Moscow first option and just drive on Moscow, not worry about the flanks on each side of Army Group Center. And he said, no, we gotta roll up the flanks and capture as many Soviet troops as possible. Then they won't have an army left, and we can just do whatever we want and drive to the Astrakhan Archangel line. And that all proved false because, the Soviet Union with a pre-war population of 180 million, which was over double the size of Germany, was able to replenish its army many times over. And then, of course, the final and most idiotic mistake of all was declaring war on the United States when it's very possible that otherwise the U.S. would have stayed out of the European war. So, he thought of himself as a military genius. He was anything but. He was, aside from his initial diplomatic victories with regards to, the annexation of the Anschluss with Austria and the Sudetenland, the Munich Pact, from then on, it was mistake after mistake, and only blitzkrieg tactics enabled him to even win the war in the West.
And he was not a very good artist, either.
Yeah, a lot of people theorize that if Germany had won World War I, or if minimally the Allies had granted a just peace to Germany, he might have just stuck to being a failed artist, and that would have been a lot better for the world.
Yeah, for a lot of folks.
But more likely, he would have still done the Nazi Party, but never would have gotten more than 5% of the vote, and he would have just been out of power perpetually, kind of the joke of Germany.
David, one of the other revelations in your articles, I did not know this. I knew there was a couple, but you said there's more than 40 known coup or assassination attempts against Hitler, one of the more famous of which was made into the movie with Tom Cruise. But do you think, looking back, if the generals or whomever had been successful at some point middle towards the end of the Second World War in deposing or otherwise getting rid of Hitler, if maybe the eventual end of the war obviously would have been faster, but the way that the Allies treated the German people after that would have been better, or did the entire Holocaust revelation pretty much ruin that forever?
So this is that's a very interesting question, and one that I've put a lot of thought into. So Churchill, both Churchill and FDR, but particularly Churchill, really hated not just Hitler and the Nazis. They hated Germany, and they supported what was called the Morgenthau Plan, which was partially implemented after the war, which was designed to deindustrialize Germany and turn it into an agricultural society incapable of supporting their entire population, resulting in millions of deaths, which is exactly what happened as billions of Germans starved to death after the war from 1945 to 1949. I do think that there is a possibility. I mean, Rommel certainly was part of the conspiracy. He had plans to make peace with the Allies. If the July 1944 coup had been successful, Rommel would have proceeded to try to arrange an armistice with the West, where Germany would essentially surrender to the Western powers, would withdraw to Germany's pre-war borders in exchange for being allowed to continue the war against the Soviets, which all the Germans thought was just and absolutely essential to preserving Germany from being communized.
David, one last question. We've got about 3 minutes, 2.5 minutes left. And I'll tell you, when I check my Google Analytics, I'm thrilled at the fact that apparently I've got a huge fan in the Ukraine. And I can't tell you how much that excites me. You, though, have bested that in that you actually were accused of Pravda of
yes.
helping the Germans potentially win the war against Russia, but you were born in 1969. Tell us that story real quick. It's kind of a chuckler.
Yeah, that's a funny story. So I was surprised. I was, I always look at the feedback, and I do name searches as many vain writers do, just to see where my articles get propagated. And I uncovered an article in Pravda, which of course, was the prime propaganda outlet for the Soviets during the communist era, and it continues to be, by the way, I would argue. And they accused me of trying to help Hitler defeat the Soviet Union, and which is was such an absurd. You know, I did a translation because it was all in Russian. You know, so I didn't even know what it said until I ran a Google Translate. And, it actually did say that. The title was, basically they thought I was a U.S. government official or defense official, I guess, trying to, help Hitler defeat the Soviet Union, in World War II, even though Hitler's, died in 45 and I was born in 69. So that was kind of a funny accusation.
Newsflash, that train's left the station. Even though German trains run on time, that one, they don't go back in time. So, David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us here today. Again, folks, you can find out more at realclearhistory.com. Be like David. Google his name, and you'll come up with some great articles. Anything else we should see coming down the line from you, sir, or look for?
I'm trying to work on a book called Turning Points, Decisions That Could Have Changed the World, that will include all of the articles that we discussed, as well as a whole lot more. I have so many projects in the work, alternate history scenarios, that I thought it would be better to include them in a book and maybe get some money for my efforts rather than publish them all piecemeal online. So
outstanding.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time today, David. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this podcast and others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. If you support what we're doing, go to Patreon.com, patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. For less than the cost of one cup of coffee a day, you can support our efforts to grow these messages. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.